So, Paul, firstly, what drew you to investigate Labour Together and its influence on the Labour Party? And at what point did you realise the extent of the corruption you were uncovering?
Right, well, first of all, thanks everyone for being here. It's nice to be in Bristol and nice to see a nice crowd as well. I mean, the story started in, you know, I was part of the Labour Party, you know, like a lot of people probably in this room and a lot of people, generally I joined the Labour Party in 2015, 2016, in response to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. The thing that sort of drew me in particularly was the 2017 manifesto. And my own particular unique interest is anti-corruption, anti-money laundering. And there was one particular clause in the manifesto, which I actually then wrote an article about in Independent, which was committing to end tax haven secrecy. There'd be public registers of tax havens. And I thought this was absolutely a revolutionary principle. And if you've done any corruption work, which I've done over the last 15 years, every single corruption case I've ever investigated, where I've been tracing the money, always ends up in a tax haven and you can't find out where it goes. So it would have been completely a revolutionary principle. But I had no particular desire to investigate the Labour Party. I'd done lots of work in South Africa. I was still very focused on South Africa. But in 2021, in rather fortuitous circumstances, and I'm afraid I can't speak entirely candidly about exactly how it transpired, but I was given access to a very substantive leak of documents out of the Labour Party. And what I was tasked with doing alongside my partner, Jessica, was looking through this material and identifying stories. And if anybody knows anything about the Labour Party, I'm sure there's some people in here were members of the Labour Party. The Labour Party is deathly boring. It really is. It's just like it's mind-numbing stuff. I mean, the vast majority of what we're looking at is people complaining to like a branch chair because they didn't take a motion and then they didn't say the right words in the standing order correctly. It's like this minutiae of like a political party sort of losing its minds over tiny rules. But then we discovered two emails. And actually it was my partner Jess who discovered them, which changed everything and sort of started us on this task of understanding Labour Together, pulling in these threads. And what these emails were is one email, this first email, was an email from a lawyer called Gerald Shamash, who's now in the House of Lords, who's put there by Keir Starmer, who was the lawyer to Labour Together. And it's an email to Morgan McSweeney, which you can now read if you want to. It's now online. It's called, if you Google the McSweeney files or what McSweeney knew, the Tories somehow got a copy of it and posted it online. But what this email was that Labour Together, which was this very anodyne-seeming think tank, very boring, very uninteresting from if you look at it from the outside, one of the things that they had one of the scandals around them is that between 2018 and 2020, they'd taken in vast amounts of money, £700,000 in donations, which they hadn't declared. And this email was between Gerald Shamash and Morgan McSweeney, and it was discussing how Labour Together should deal with this fact. Because at that stage, Labour Together would be put under investigation by the Electoral Commission. And it's basically, it's a very, quite a complex email, but effectively, one of the things you take away from this is, well, actually, it seems like there is, it seems plausible from this email that actually this failure to report donations may have been purposeful. Which was incredibly shocking to read. And it's an absolutely damning email. And the second email is a set of emails between involving a cabinet minister by the name of Steve Reid, who is now the Minister for Local Communities and Housing, absolute political ally over decades and decades of Morgan McSweeney, and probably one of the last true Starmer loyalists. And what this email was it was the assistant to Steve Reid was putting together a briefing note for the Jewish Chronicle, talking about the work of Labour Together, because Jewish Chronicle was planning to do a puff piece interview with Steve Reid. And it listed all these things that Labour Together had done. It said Labour Together was involved in Keir Starmer's leadership campaign. It said Labour Together was deeply involved in the fight against anti-Semitism. Labour Together was involved in the fight against fake news. But none of that is public. And when we looked at this, we were like, what on earth are you talking about? There's no record at all in the public domain. If you look to, you know, at that stage, 2021, we were looking at this stuff. Morgan McSweeney is a tiny, boring-seeming guy. Labour Together looks like the most boring think tank, pretending to be just a cross-factional thing to convene discussions in the Labour Party. And yet, we have these documents saying, actually, Labour Together is doing all this other stuff behind the scenes. And at that point, we started realizing, we started pulling this thread about the anti-Semitism crisis, about Labour Together, about Morgan McSweeney. And we started realizing that we'd seen this transformation in the Labour Party. We'd come across these individual stories, which are pretty horrific in and of themselves, of serious misconduct. And we thought they were just sort of individual incidents in the Labour Party. And then we realized this is actually just one story. This is one story of the Labour Together project from 2017 effectively to now, of this covert, almost entirely despicable campaign to sort of launch a war on British democracy and the war on the Labour Party using the most underhanded dirty tricks you could possibly imagine, and causing vast damage, just vast democratic damage to the Labour Party itself, but to sort of the fabric of our society and particularly into community relations as well. So that's what got us pulling this thread. A little did we know, when we started pulling that thread, we really had found something that upset them, because then they started throwing their dogs at us.
Thank you, Paul.
So, why do you think the likes of McSweeney thought it was a good idea to go after such mainstream journalists?
Sure. So for those of you who don't know the context here, and this story has broken in bits and pieces over the last year, but certainly from February onwards, is that in November 2023, armed with these documents, it was very clear I'd been planning to write a book about the Labour Party, this book, and it was just absolutely clear that I was never going to get this book done in time. I was deeply disturbed by the very profoundly anti-democratic, unlawful conduct that I had come across. It was absolutely plain to me, looking at this stuff, especially around the donations, that somebody like Morgan McSweeney is a disaster to have in government. You just cannot have somebody like that in government, because he brings with him all sorts of misconduct, like appointing Peter Mandelson. You know, I know from the South African experience, if you have characters like this at the heart of government, it produces like really profound malignant effects on our democracy. And I went to the Sunday Times in November 2023, and I said, these are the documents that I have. These are the documents about the donations. Simultaneously, I went to Matt Taibbi in the States. He's a US journalist, and he'd been writing a lot of stuff about the way in which the Biden White House had been intervening around free speech issues, which sort of cross-pollinated, from my perspective, in how the Biden White House was colluding with actors to sort of suppress speech around Palestine. And I gave the documents to the Sunday Times. The Sunday Times ran the story in November 2023. It was called The Secretive Guru who Propelled Starmer to Power with Undeclared Money. At the bottom of this article, it said the documents for this article being provided by Paul Holden, who's working on a book. And unbeknownst to me at the time, but now we know a lot more detail, is that within days of that article coming out, Labour Together appointed a reputation management firm called APCO Worldwide. Now, this is reputation management firm is a very polite way of saying dustbuster. These are the sort of firms that, like, you know, this is the sort of company, the management reputation management firm that arms dealers and tobacco companies and oil companies hire. You hire APCO if you have a problem. You don't hire APCO to advertise your good services. You hire APCO to deal with issues that might affect your reputation. And they were instructed to investigate me, find out what I knew, who I was, where I got my information from, what my sourcing was. And it's very clear the contract that's signed between APCO and Labour Together says very explicitly, APCO will develop a package of materials that will proactively undermine this material, will generate media narratives that will undermine this work. So to be very clear, what they were saying is that they were going to go and find whatever information they could to use to make sure that my factually accurate public interest reporting was undermined in the public domain. And it's a crazy, mad, long story, but basically APCO engages in this absolutely ludicrous, mad investigation into me. Then it extends to my family, extremely invasive. I've now seen these final reports. They, you know, identified our home address. They met my family. They contracted a person in South Africa to provide intelligence on me and my colleagues. Totally made up, fabricated nonsense. The end point of which was that they produced this report that said that myself and my colleagues were proxies of Russia, and that we were receiving hacked materials given to us by Russia because we were secretly South African intelligence agents and we were cut out. So, I mean, this is total ludicrous nonsense. It's like so beyond ludicrous, not least because me and Andrew Feinstein, who I've been working for 15 years, we've investigated Russian oligarchs. We've been sued by Russian oligarchs. We can't even travel to Russia because we've been told that we'll be killed. We've investigated Russian arms dealers. This is not a credible allegation. But not only was this report completed, we have now seen that APCO produced this report. I now know this report was given to Morgan McSweeney. I now know it was given to Paul Overton, who was the head of communications. It was apparently spread widely. Apparently Peter Mandelson got a copy all the way through Westminster. And then Labour Together reported me to the security services, trying to claim that I was a Russian agent, effectively, trying to catalyse a criminal investigation, potentially. Because the one email says, crime complaint, this is what you should submit. And the reason why the story broke, and it says a lot about the media, obviously this stuff is despicable from my perspective. To be honest, the mainstream media doesn't really care about me. But the mad thing was that APCO went totally off-piste and started investigating the Sunday Times journalist I worked with, and put the Sunday Times journalist, Gabriel Pogrel, who's just broken the Nigel Farage story this week, he was also investigated, and they also said mad things about him as well in this final report. And there's an internal document we saw which APCO listed a whole bunch of other journalists of people of interest. Now, what does seem to be very clear to me is that, you know, the person who's taken the rap for this is Josh Simons, and I'm not going to say that Josh Simons shouldn't take the rap for it, but it's clear to me that he was working, that this was not a Labour Together story, this is not an APCO story, this is a Labour Together, APCO, Labour Party story. At the highest levels of the Labour Party knew that they were doing this. They knew they were doing this to tackle a journalist who had the story about the money. That's what they were so scared of. And basically it was this, you know, they panicked. And they panicked because the proof is, it's damning, it's utterly damning about the money. There's just no way you look at the material that we've gotten, the FOIs have gotten, these documents together, and you think, this is legit. That it makes sense that they just forgot to report this money. And then if you then dig deeper into what they've been doing with this money, I mean, just crazy projects, AstroTurf campaigns, attacking independent media, trying to destroy the livelihoods of other journalists who are investigating them. It is like one of, you know, a really genuinely profound scandal that at the time really could have threatened the ability, at least of Morgan McSweeney, to be part of the incoming Labour government. I mean, there was really, you know, I think they were genuinely scared of the story, and they were right to be. And I think it says a lot, you know, personally, I think the stuff that they did, it worked. Because in the end, it did actually chill the reporting on it. Basically, it was only when I published my book, and I sort of smuggled the book into public domain, that we were able to put that story about the money out there for the first time in full. Sadly, it was too late.
Thank you, Paul. And this next question is kind of leads on from that. I suppose it's, you know, of everything going on in the news with Nigel Farage and reform and money and stuff as well, this might be a good question. But how prevalent do you think it is for the large political parties to use private security firms to go after their detractors like journalists and activists?
It's a bit hard to know. I mean, my sense is that there is a deep dysfunction that has inflected our politics and the relationship between the media and these agencies. I mean, John McDonnell, for example, has been calling specifically for an inquiry into Labour Together and into APCO as well, because they've been putting in subject access requests into APCO. and trying to find what they know about them. And APCO has been giving these subject access requests back, just totally blacked out, like barely readable, you know, illegible stuff. The stuff that I've got from APCO is also very heavily redacted as well. I mean, the thing that disturbed me about the APCO story was, you know, I've said this is a Labour Together APCO story, but it's also a bit of like a media is a broken story as well. Because, and excuse me for going into the weeds here, it's important to map out some of the relationships behind the APCO story, because it's very revealing. So who's involved? First of all, it's Josh Simons, who, as we now know, because of the scandal, stood aside for Andy Burnham. Looks like he's going to take a role in number 10, which I think is very problematic. He hires APCO. Now, he hires APCO because on the board of Labour Together is a woman by the name of Kate Forrester, who's also a director of APCO Worldwide. She's a board advisor to Labour Together and on the board of APCO. She is the wife of Paul Ovenden, who is the head of communications at the Labour Party, who has to resign because of my book, because I reveal text messages about him. The person who leads the investigation for APCO is a man by the name of Tom Harper, who's a former journalist. His wife is Caroline Wheeler, who's the political editor of the Sunday Times, right? So when I'm taking a story to the Sunday Times and I'm, you know, it's getting reported on, and there's this mad investigation, it's plain that there are these totally blurred lines between our politicians, the media, and these companies. And what we do know is that, you know, somebody like Christopher Steele is repeatedly being hired to undertake opposition research. We saw it on the Russiagate stuff. I mean, the one story that I think is really despicable, which hasn't been covered in the UK press at all, you know, and it flows from this investigation, is one of the companies that gets involved in this stuff is a company by the name of Audere International. And I highly recommend everybody in this room Google them. Because one of the things that, you know, the reason, I'll give you a bit of an inside baseball story about how we actually came to know this story. The only reason we found out about this is because there was a journalist that I knew from South Africa who worked for something called the Overseas Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP. And OCCRP had been approached by a whistleblower who was working for one of these firms, or multiple whistleblowers, I think. And what had happened is that there was this massive US multinational health firm called Seward International, involved in vast misconduct around the world, including allegedly paying bribes in places like Malta. And they'd hired Audere International to basically deal with these allegations, deal with whistleblowers, and deal with one businessman in particular who'd been writing about it. And one of the stories that OCCRP broke is that Audere was paid money to Christopher Steele to get Liam Byrne, an MP, to ask a question under parliamentary privilege, accusing this businessman of being a Russian spy. Ruined his life. Cost him millions and millions and millions of pounds. I think this sort of thing is extremely common, that there is like no gap between these intelligence firms, these blaggers, these private investigators, newsrooms, and politicians. You know, to me, the story is like the ultimate example of why we need another Leveson. It's just rotten, really is, top to bottom.
You alluded to it a little bit, but with Josh Simons, you know, a central figure in Labour Together, standing aside in Makerfield to allow Burnham to run for that seat, are we likely to see any difference in the relationship between then and the Cabinet Office?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. So it does seem likely that Josh Simons is going to play quite a prominent role in the Burnham campaign. And I suppose the sort of the underlying question is the Labour Together project still functional? So maybe I should go back a bit and describe what the Labour Together project is. So very top-line summary, very quickly. There's basically two phases to the Labour Together project, right? Well, maybe three. The first phase, 2017 to 2020, that's the Morgan McSweeney phase, where Morgan McSweeney uses Labour Together to launch an undeclared war on the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. in which thing he does things like he gets involved in anti-Semitism crisis. He's working with allies to place stories in the media, undisclosed covertly that he's placing these stories about the anti-Semitism crisis. He's also simultaneously incubating Keir Starmer's leadership campaign. And it's in July 2019 that they start working together with the idea of running Keir Starmer's leadership campaign in whenever there's the next general election. And then Morgan McSweeney, as the director of Labour Together, also then runs Keir Starmer's leadership campaign, which I call one of the most mendacious political campaigns in history, because this is actually McSweeney's fundamental methodology, which is sort of deep, profound, premeditated dishonesty and misdirection as a political tactic. And that phase concludes with Keir Starmer winning, because basically then Labour Together goes dormant, Morgan McSweeney goes into the machinery, he appoints all his allies, they take over the party, and they really do transform it top to bottom. One of the things they do is that Morgan McSweeney with his allies is hand-picking all the incoming MPs, right? So of the 400 MPs that are sitting in the Labour Party now, 260 of them have been handpicked by Morgan McSweeney, right? And this is where the second phase of the Labour Together project happens, which is basically in late 2022, as it's very clear the Labour Party is going to win the next election because this trust has blown up everything, Labour Together is reactivated. And it serves two roles primarily. One is it's supposed to be this place where they generate policy that's going to inform the Labour government. So they get loads and loads of money from millionaire donors, and they start writing very right-wing policy. They basically write the papers that justifies the Labour Party going so far to the right on to the cultural issues, on the economy. And they sort of they provide the intellectual underpinning for the Labour Party going being almost indistinguishable from the Tories by 2024. But the second key thing that they do is that they've taken millions of pounds of donations, which they are then subsequently using to fund the election campaigns of the incoming Labour MPs. There's 110 Labour MPs, roughly, whose election campaigns in 2024 are entirely funded by Labour Together. So it's this weird hybrid entity, which is effectively an outrider for Morgan McSweeney, where Morgan McSweeney is choosing the candidates internally. Labour Together is funding them. Labour Together is taking money. It's writing the policy as well. And it was extremely, this project in 2024, it won totally. Because if you look at Starmer's cabinet, every single senior member of Starmer's cabinet was a Labour Together associate. Rachel Reeves, Wes Streeting, Bridget Phillipson, Lucy Powell, Shabana Mahmood, these are all Labour Together insiders. This is a Labour Together cabinet, it's a Labour Together parliament. But now this project has failed. It's basically collapsed. I mean, Labour Together doesn't exist anymore, even. It's been renamed Think Labour because of the scandal around Josh Simons in the book. They've said they won't fight any more MPs, they're going to do policy work, they're totally transforming what they do. Morgan McSweeney's out of power. Keir Starmer's out of power. A lot of the Labour Together MPs are out of power. So, in that sense, the Labour Together project has been disrupted. But it's already succeeded to an extent because it's already chosen the parliamentarians. It's already made up the PLP. They've already created a structure so that somebody like Shabana Mahmood is a big dog that Andy Burnham has to negotiate with. Wes Streeting is a big dog that he has to negotiate with. He is still constrained by the power that's been granted to these people through this project. And I mean, really the test of this, people have different opinions, but the test of whether Burnham can succeed, and succeed would be to win the next election, and really to win the next election it means cohering a left coalition at this point, is really a question of to what extent can he break free of the Labour Together project's influence? Because if he doesn't, he's doomed, plainly. Because they will constrain him doing anything marginally left-wing on the economy, on civil liberties, on Gaza. And I got to say, right now, I'm not making any swift judgments, but I'm not super excited. I'm skeptical.
Yeah, I think we probably all feel that way. Okay, so finally, just before I then open up the floor to questions and contributions, and you kind of answered it there a little bit, but. So it could be concluded that the Labour Together project has successfully crushed the left-wing faction of the party. Do you believe that there will ever be a way back, or did it really end with Corbyn's era?
I mean, it's a tough question. So, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about I've been asked by Navarra to write an obituary for Keir Starmer. Political obituary, not an actual obituary. Come on, guys, seriously. And the thing that really struck me, I've been sort of thinking about it and I've been writing about it, and, you know, obviously the way in which Starmer's, you know, has had to leave is this very weird, quite surreal process, because really, he should have left 6 months ago. He should have left before the local elections. He should have left as soon as the Mandelson stuff happened. But basically, the Labour Party is so messed up that they had to sort of create a situation where there could be somebody they could bring from the outside to save them. So he sort of left with like the pace of treacle, and people don't quite understand what's actually caused his demise. I mean, one of the things is Mandelson, but really the proximate cause of his failure is very clear, is the local elections. With the local elections, the Labour Party got a projected average vote share of 17%. It's the worst Labour Party has performed, I think, in 80 years in terms of local elections, right? And the thing that's very interesting about this is that if you look at all the places the Labour Party lost votes, where they lost to the Greens in particular, huge, I mean, this happened again and again and again. I've been traveling the country, meeting people and writing about local democracy as well, is that again and again and again, the people that beat the Labour Party on behalf of the Greens are people who were in the Labour Party. Again and again and again, the people who were in the Labour Party, who left, they went to the Greens, they found a new political home, they mobilised, and they beat the Labour Party. And sometimes it was extremely dramatic. So Jamie Driscoll, good example. You know, he's forced out the Labour Party in the most ridiculous circumstances for speaking to Ken Loach. I mean, come on. And he then leaves, forms mainstream, joins a Green Party in Newcastle. This is a council the Labour Party has controlled for decades. There's 76 councillor spots that were up for election this last election in Newcastle. It's now basically a three-way split between the Lib Dems, Reform and the Greens. The Labour Party controlled their council. They had 50 councillors before the election. They now have two. Right? Lambeth is another example, where it is a council that has been entirely controlled by the Labour Party. Since 2010, there's 56 councillor seats. 56 Labour councillors have been elected in Lambeth at every local election since 2010. It's now controlled by the Greens. And the leader of the council is Martin Abrams. He's an ex-Labour person, ex-Jewish Labour councillor, who's forced out of the Labour Party because of a stance on Gaza. So what, you know, one of the issues with the left is that it's vociferous. It breaks into factions. It never organises and expresses electoral force, except for now. This is probably one of the first elections in modern British political history where the left has cohered outside of the Labour Party, to its left, and achieved electoral success and extracted a toll on the Labour Party. Now, of course, the mainstream media will never admit this is what's caused Starmer to resign, but that's actually what's caused Starmer to resign, is the left has basically forced him out. So one of the consequences of the McSweeney project is the McSweeney project has been so horrific, it's so awful, and so factional, and so intolerant, that it's actually incidentally created an electoral force to its left that can cohere into something powerful. And that's almost like that's the gift of the McSweeney project, in a sense, is that it showed that you can have an electoral politics outside of it. As much as I love John McDonald and the SAG people, and I go talk to them, and they've been incredibly supportive, my gut feeling is that we have the last decade as something to learn from. And if you were going to learn any lessons from the last decade, one of the lessons is that the Labour Party just could not tolerate a left leadership. It's not a party that was able to reconcile itself to the idea that the left could be dominant. So the question is, was there ever a Corbyn moment that could be successful in the Labour Party? Is there something that's even viable in the Labour Party, really, realistically, if you're looking at the last decade? Because I think one of the lessons I've learned from the last decade is that actually maybe it isn't possible to have a Labour Party that has Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott and John McDonnell and Ian Byrne that also has Luke Akhurst. I'm not sure that that's a gap that can be bridged. And I'm not sure that there's enough of an internal commitment to like fair play democracy, because really the Labour Together project is a deep and profound repudiation of the most basic democratic norms. It's not internal faction fighting, it's not skullduggery, it is systematic rejection of the basic principles of how democracy functions. You know, accepting losing, telling the truth, making commitments you stick to. This is a rejection fundamentally of the basic democratic principles of how you're supposed to function in a political party. I'm not entirely convinced that the Labour Party is able to actually contain a left, like a Corbynite left, that is actually powerful. Doesn't mean it can't be a soft left, it doesn't mean it can't work in coalition, doesn't mean that Andy Burnham will be better than Starmer, because he plainly will be. Don't know if he'll be enough, but it'll be better. But maybe the lesson we need to learn is that maybe it just isn't possible to cohere a project like that anymore.
Thank you so much, Paul. That was so fascinating. So we're going to open it up now for questions or contributions. If I take three or four and then come back to you, Paul, and then we'll do a couple of rounds. We've got plenty of time, so... oh, gosh, all the hands are up. I think the chap at the back there first. Yeah.
If we send you back in time to, say, 2014...
Right. So let me take the, you know, the LFI. I mean, this is obviously... There's so much to cover, but, you know, one of... A key part of the book is to trace the history of the anti-Semitism crisis. And then to understand not just the origins of the anti-Semitism crisis and sort of critique it, but then also to understand its sort of long-term social impact, in particular in relation to Gaza. Now, I should just say, you know, that the anti-Semitism crisis in the Labour Party is a very complicated, nuanced thing, and, you know, there is obviously plainly anti-Semitism on the left because it happens everywhere in society. But it's obviously very clear from my investigation that the role played by Morgan McSweeney and his colleagues was to sort of promiscuously make unfounded or reckless allegations of anti-Semitism in order to create the impression that the Labour Party was intrinsically, inherently, inexorably anti-Semitic. And that flowed from its anti-imperialism, or in its worst instances, it flowed inexorably from a position of pro-Palestinian solidarity. And it's plain that you know, Trevor Chin plays a key role in the story as a funder. I mean, he is also a board member of Labour Together. So he's a board member of Labour Together between 2016 and 2022. And one of the documents that we discovered, one of the things that led us on this investigation, was we found the set of minutes of a meeting between Steve Reed and the Board of Deputies, the Jewish Leadership Council, CST, at which Trevor Chin is there. And he speaks openly in this meeting, but he basically endorses Steve Reed and speaks about the role of Labour Together in fighting the anti-Semitism crisis. So it's plain that Chin knows, at least to some extent, although we don't know the full extent, but he knows to some extent that Labour Together and Morgan McSweeney are involved in this stuff, and he knows that it's not being disclosed. And it's very clear what his politics and his principles are, because he's been very clear and explicit about what they are. Because he said explicitly in that interview in 2013, I've dedicated my life to Israel. You know, I spent my life working for Israel. In 2024, he was given the Presidential Medal of Honor by Isaac Herzog, the Israeli Presidential Medal of Honor for services to Israel and humanity. And it's plain that, you know, this money is fundamental to both Labour Together's success, because he's one of the two big funders of Labour Together in that period. He's also a board member, but he's also a big funder of Keir Starmer's leadership campaign. And it's it's incredibly telling. You know, one of the things we tend to forget is that during Starmer's leadership campaign, he refused to reveal those donors. He only revealed half of them. The two donors he refused to reveal were Trevor Chin and Martin Taylor, who are also the donors behind Labour Together. What we've seen more recently is that we've actually seen some of the nuts and bolts of what Morgan McSweeney was doing behind the scenes, what he was doing with this money from Trevor Chin. And one of the things that they were doing was they were minutely monitoring and polling the membership. And they were One of the questions they were monitoring, it was so dystopian. What they were doing was that on the one hand, they were working covertly with the media to place these stories. On the other hand, they were polling the party membership to see how the stories were landing with the membership, saying, like, do you think that anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is being mishandled by Jeremy Corbyn? And actually, the polling shows that the vast majority of Labour Party members believed that it was basically nonsense. Half of the Labour Party members were saying, we think this is exaggerated in order to infect, you know. Another 25% said, there's something here, but it's also being exaggerated to protect Israel. I mean, it cross-pollinates, all of the stuff cross-pollinates with Labour Friends of Israel, because that's an organising principle. And I've been thinking about this a lot, because obviously this is not a project just about Israel. I think there's a tendency to be like, the motivating force behind all of us is just Israel. It's not. I think the key thing, I remember speaking to a Labour Party insider, a left-winger, who said it to me very clearly, which is that In the Labour Party, Israel and Palestine is the Labour Party's Brexit. It's one of those defining issues that where you situate yourself in that conflict, whether you, you know, basically are critical of Israel, you think it should be boycotted, like I do, or you think that, you know, you side with Israel and you think it's the only democracy in the Middle East, whatever. Generally speaking, the people who hold those sets of beliefs will also hold other sets of beliefs. It's a marker. It's a distinguishing feature. If you are pro-Palestine, you generally tend to be anti-imperialist. You generally tend to be more left-wing. You generally tend to be more socialist. If you're pro-Israel, you generally tend to be reconciled to the security state. You generally tend to be reconciled to all the things that Counter-Fire fights against, right? It's a marker. So on the one hand, obviously Israel is a feature of this fight back, and plainly people like Trevor Chin would only be funding Keir Starmer and Labour together if he believed that it was assisting in his campaign to help Israel, because he said explicitly, this is what I dedicate my life to. But on the other hand, it's also a way in which the Labour Party can be organised and disaggregated and then separated against itself and then targeted to make sure that the left wing is annihilated. Because if you basically make, and this is effectively what happened to the Labour Party, is it became effectively impossible to have a robust opinion on Israel that was pro-Palestinian without being investigated at the very least, you know, if you're putting that up on social media. And if that's the case, you basically erasing the left's ability to function in the Labour Party. And that's the vector. And this is where it gets really ugly for me. This is sort of my profound critique of this stuff, is that my sense is that it's made our society more divided. I think it's created a horrible, profound, deep distrust and divide between the Jewish community here and left-wing politics. I think that it has made Jewish people feel less safe. I think it's had the impact of targeting repeatedly and systematically anti-Zionist and left-wing Jews. I know so many of them who've been investigated and expelled, including the story I tell of Reva Joffe, who was investigated on her deathbed, died under investigation because she posted in support of BDS, right? What the anti-Semitism crisis did was it took a base instinct, which was factionalism, envy, control, an anti-democratic tantrum, a need to control the political party because that's the way you make money, you sell access to it. There are loads of people in the Labour Party who are unemployable outside of the Labour Party and the ecosystem of lobbying. And that base anti-democratic tantrum was laundered to the anti-Semitism crisis as a moral campaign when it wasn't. Because if it's a moral campaign, it needs to be consistent, and it actually needs to be moral. Because how moral can a campaign be if it leads to the systematic targeting of left-wing anti-Zionist Jews? And how moral can the campaign be if it leads to supporting Israel during a genocide? There is no morality there. Right? Which is a long way of saying, yes, it's an incredibly important part of the story, but it's not the whole story. But it's also a devastating part of the story, because I think it's made society sick. I'll say one more thing on this, because I know I'm speaking too long. No, but fine. One of the things that I think is really misunderstood about the anti-Semitism crisis, the way it's played out, the way it's formed as like a touchstone in the mainstream narrative, one of the really damaging things is it's basically confirmed a far-right narrative of our society, a far-right diagnosis of our society, which is that left-wing and Muslim people present a material threat to Jewish people. That is Farage's and the far-right's argument for why the left needs to be crushed. That is the end point of this anti-Semitism crisis. It's actually, and the malignancy that produces society-wide, the amount of, this is a project that systematically inflamed ethnic tensions for power, and, you know, inflamed ethnic tensions and then reaped power from the chaos. And the damage it's done to Jewish people and non-Jewish people is so profound that I think that we have decades of recovery here. Starburn ideology. Then I'll come to the question about time travel. By the way, my daughter, who's 7 years old, has convinced when she was six that she invented a time machine. She did not. She absolutely did not. She drew a time machine on a piece of paper. Let me start with that one. I genuinely don't know, because, you know, the issue is that I did try to stop it. I went to the media in 2023, and it sort of got reported, but it sort of didn't. It didn't actually break as a story in the way it should have. So many of the stories from the book still haven't broken, right? Like, this book is filled with stuff that could be used to disrupt Starmerism. You know, really damning evidence, which has just been utterly ignored. You know, really damning evidence about Steve Reed, all these people. So my strong sense is that what it would have done is it would have given the left an analytical understanding. I think it would have done almost nothing in terms of disrupting the media coverage for what's happening. Because the media coverage half the time wasn't in good faith anyway. And it isn't in good faith still. It's still not in good faith. But maybe one of the things we could have learned is that I think the one real big failure of the Labour Party under Corbyn, like the deep failure of it, was that it didn't properly embed grassroots democracy in the party. That was the fundamental failure. And I think if we'd done that, if the one thing the Labour Party could have done is bring in open primaries, it would have transformed the Labour Party totally. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's open primaries that produces Zora Mamdani. It's open primaries that produce, you know, all these incredible, you know, candidates in America who are running for Senate. And the failure to do that was the seeds of its own destruction. I really think so. Because it was so quick. That's the thing, is that it's, you know, they never did anything to disrupt the bureaucracy, to put power in the hands of the members, trust the members fully to run this democracy, which meant that as soon as they lost power, control of the bureaucracy, it was like that. This bureaucracy the Labour Party has to police its membership is so overpowered, it's so strong, that if you have somebody like Morgan McSweeney or David Evans who comes in and just wants to use brute bureaucratic force, they can just totally transform the party, which is what they did. They really did. From top to bottom, it's been transformed. Councillor level, MP level, inside the bureaucracy as well. So maybe that could have stopped it, or maybe we could have done something at that point to embed a more democratic culture, which maybe would have had a better long-term outcome. Does he have ideology? Sorry, I know I'm speaking long. I'll answer this quickly if I can. I mean, the short answer is no. I think it's pretty clear, and it's remarkable to me the extent to which everybody basically, even the centrist mainstream media, basically says he has no politics and no political economy. Famously, you know, when he was meeting with staff members behind the scenes, and they said, you know, we need to write the paper to define Starmerism. He said, there's no such thing as Starmerism, yeah. Right? And I think the thing to understand about Starmer is that he approached being the leader of the Labour Party like he approaches being a barrister, which is that, you know, it's both dishonest and not dishonest, you know. Obviously, Keir Starmer is a deeply dishonest man because he's made all sorts of promises that he's broken in a heartbeat, and he just lies constantly about things that he said and done, which I detail throughout the book. To give you a flavour, my publisher asked me to put together a list of every single pledge or commitment that Starm had made during the Labour leadership election. And I said, sure, I'll do that. And I spent 3 months reading everything he ever said. And I put together a table, and it was so long that we can't fit it into the book. We've had to put it online because I was like, I made the book like that much thicker, right? So he understood his role as a Labour leader. It was not to develop policy, not to develop ideology, not to lead in that sense. But every day he was given a brief. He was given a brief by Morgan McSweeney and his political advisors, and his job that day was to present that brief as best as he could, like a barrister does. He made the argument as best as he could. And if it meant that he made a different argument on Monday than he made on Wednesday, it doesn't matter, because that's his job, is to approach it like a barrister. That doesn't mean that there's not something about Starmer that colours this project. And there are a couple of things that are really important. The one, you know, he has certain traits if he doesn't have ideology. One is, and I think probably the most profound one, is his deep authoritarian instincts, which is long-standing. It's not just something that you know, when he became a Labour leader. I tell the story, which is based on some of Oliver Eagleton's work, you know, very briefly, when he was DPP, his record as Director of Public Prosecutions is pretty abysmal on this sort of stuff. So I give the example of Gary McKinnon. Gary McKinnon was an autistic IT savant. You might remember the story. Who hacked into the Pentagon and NASA because he was trying to find out whether aliens existed. And then left a whole bunch of sort of snarky messages saying, your security's crap, or something like that. Sort of poking the nose of poking the eyes of the CIA. And the CIA went mad. And NASA, the security state in America went mad. And they were like, we need to extradite this guy and put him into jail for 70 years. We'll put him in Supermax. And it was abundantly clear that if he goes to Supermax in America, he'll die. His mother was very clear. If he goes there, he will commit suicide. He's depressive. He's got serious learning disabilities. This will kill him. And the mother of Gary McKinnon was repeatedly approaching Keir Starmer and saying, please, can you do something about this? And Keir Starmer could resolve this. Because basically, if Keir Starmer had decided the CPS would charge this offence, then he wouldn't be extradited. And even, you know, Gary McKinnon's lawyer said, we will plead guilty in the UK. We'll plead guilty. He'll do jail time here to make sure he doesn't go. And in the end, it's Theresa May who blocks his extradition. And Starmer is so angry and so upset that he flies to America to meet with the Attorney General, Eric Holder, to apologise for the failure to extradite this guy. We saw with his response to the London riots as well, the way he personally rewrote the sentencing guidelines and made sure that people who were being picked up for taking a bottle of water were being prosecuted not for theft, but for aggravated burglary. Right? And you had people, 16, 17, going to night courts. It was a total travesty of justice, right? That's the one thing that really runs through, is that Starmer is both... He's the worst combination of things, because on the one hand, he's a deep and profound coward. He is terrified of other powerful people. Again and again and again in the story that I tell, he makes a decision and he relents because a powerful person shouts at him. It happens again and again and again. And at the same time, he loves clothing himself in the power of the state to punch down. And there is no, for me, one of the most deeply, profoundly problematic aspects of this government has been it's a deep, really, like, profound war on our civil liberties. You know, Palestine Action is the clear case. I just did an article in Zetia this week, and I've done some things for Owen as well, about this new law they're bringing in, which they're rushing through in the last weeks, which is devastating. It's absolutely terrifying, these laws, right? The attack on free speech and civil liberties is so profound. And that, I think, is something that's inherent to Starmerism. That's the only thing that is, I think, is unique to him. And which I think makes him comfortable with the more egregious attacks on civil liberties. Let me start with the PR question. I think it would make a big difference. I think what you have, you know, first past the post produces all sorts of, you know, problematic outcomes. One of which, of course, is the current majority, which makes no sense. Because if you look at this is the most disproportionate parliament in history in terms of national vote share. On the back of the lowest voter turnout since universal suffrage. Right, that's the thing that's interesting about the 2024 general election is that, you know, it's held up as the sign of Labour's victory, but actually it was very plain that the Labour Party was not particularly popular. Keir Starmer himself was almost negligible as a feature within that campaign in terms of why people voted. They just hated the Tories. But it is bizarre that they have this massive majority on effectively 34-35% of the vote. If you factor in people who didn't vote, only 20% of the population actually voted for the Labour Party. And it's a very unstable situation to be in, where you have a political party which has such overwhelming... I mean, we have this very unstable alignment of forces right now, which is where you have a Labour Party itself, which is disconnected from its grassroots, which is effectively being captured by this tiny political faction that has used its bureaucracy to create a pretty thin power structure, sitting on top of a parliamentary majority, which is not backed by a huge amount of popular support, and which has collapsed, you know, incredibly rapidly. And what's very clear is that first past the post produces sort of a cartel party politics, which is where, really, realistically, for, you know, pretty much the last 100 years, you could only vote for one of two parties if you want to achieve political power. And it produces these very bizarre outcomes because, and I always think of this in sociological terms, like if you are right-wing, if you're a Blairite, if you are, you know, maybe to the right of Tony Blair, which is quite hard to be at this point in time, considering that he's basically a tech bro at this point, but you're politically ambitious and you live in Camden, in London. What sort of political influence can you have if you don't join the Labour Party? None. If you're in a place like Newham, for example, it's a one-party state in Newham. It's a one-party state in Lambeth. It has been for a long period of time. And what it meant was that, you know, you basically had people who understood, first of all, that if they wanted to have political influence, even though they were right-wing, they had to join the Labour Party anyway. But they also understood, and this is the key thing about the Labour Together project, is they understand that people don't like them. Nobody wants their politics. When people actually get to vote for their politics, they reject it. Morgan McSweeney, before he led Keir Starmer's campaign, led Liz Kendall's leadership campaign. She got 4.5% of the vote, right? And basically what the Labour right does, and this particular faction does, is that they understand that they need to capture this political party and then basically use this position of institutional power and dominance through the first past the post to force people to vote for them, to hold them to ransom. And there's a very clear example of this, right? There was a report that was published called Redshift in 2023, which is Labour Together published this report. It's the intellectual foundation behind the Labour Party's 2024 general election campaign, based on loads of polling. And the takeaway from that was that they basically said, we need to win the election, we have to target these conservative voters. What is the chance that if we go basically to the far right on immigration, culture, war stuff, we'll lose our activist left? And their polling was saying, we won't at all. So we can do whatever we want. In fact, we can punch the activist left as much as we want, because it actually proves to the conservative voters we want to get that this is a changed political party. And that's why Diane Abbott's treated so badly and that sort of stuff. And that really can only function when voters are captured, when voters have no choice, where they basically have to vote for this political party as the only mechanism of getting the Tories out. PR changes that fundamentally. I think it changes our democracy very fundamentally. You know, there's problems with PR in its own way. South Africa is pure PR, and that produces its own problems, right, with party lists and lack of constituency accountability. It's not, you know, a perfect system, but I definitely think that we'd have a healthier democratic system. It's also, at this point, we're effectively already in a five-party political environment. And unless we have PR, you know, we are going to constantly have this churn of governments coming in on a tiny fraction of the vote with big majorities because of just how perverse first past the post is. So I did think it would make a huge difference. I mean, what is the I think people overestimate how much power Andy Burnham has. I think that's the key issue. Is that obviously he's, you know, the leader of the Labour Party has quite a lot of power because they can appoint a general secretary, da da da. But he comes in from outside of the party. He comes in the Labour Party that's doing very badly in the polls. He comes into a party where there's 400 MPs who are pissed off and angry and scared and disloyal and also sort of ideologically incoherent. Like there's no sense of the people that have been chosen actually have a political project. And the moment it seems, first of all, that Andy Burnham is failing, they'll turn on him. And if there's a sense that Andy Burnham is trying to do things like introduce Labour Party democracy, they'll also turn on him. Because there's 260 MPs who will not survive Labour Party democracy. They won't be selected again, because they weren't selected half the time by their own constituencies in the first place. My sense is that he may have good instincts. I think that's true. I think he's more left-wing generally than Keir Starmer. That's not hard. But he comes into such a difficult situation where his power is really much less than people think it is. And he's going to be hemmed in on all sides by this project. He really is. It doesn't mean it's fatal, but this is the card. This is the hand he's been dealt. And I think he has 3 to 6 months. Really, 3 to 6 months, if he doesn't rapidly change Labour Party's position in the polls, if he makes one serious mistake, it's just going to be rats in a sack at this point. And I do think that the Labour Together project survives, because somebody like Shabana Mahmood is going to be Home Secretary. And my sense is the gamble is what he's going to do. He's going to appoint Ed Miliband as the Chancellor, do some marginally left-wing things around public ownership, around state investment, and he'll basically balance that off by giving Foreign Secretary, Home Office, sort of the worst part of the security state to the right wing. That's the deal he's going to do, and that's how he's going to buy the compliance of the right-wing media. And I just... that means nothing's going to change on Gaza, for example. I think that's the reality we have to face. And it's not forever. This is dynamic. We can put pressure from the left, but that's the situation. I feel like I've been speaking for a long time and I haven't come to all the questions.
That's okay.
I'm going to answer that question very quickly. Yes, it would have made a big difference. Two, there's been a real blow to that yesterday. I'm not sure if people have seen the judgment in the High Court. Judge Nicklin found against Dorian Lawrence, Hugh Grant, in favour of the Daily Mail and Associated Press, which is a real blow to the cause for Leveson too. It really is massive. So in that context, you know, I can't see it gaining a huge amount of traction right now. It is something that I've been thinking a lot about how we need to leverage some of this work, and it's something we will do. I mean, and we are thinking about doing some follow-up books about specifically this, about the... I think that's probably where we're going to take the next investigation, is trying to explain the extent to which the media has facilitated the Starmer project. And I'll give you some, you know, people sort of overestimate, you know, people think that I'm being overdramatic when I say that the media created Starmerism. And I'll give you a very clear example of how the media directly intervened to protect Starmer and make sure that he was Prime Minister. Right. So in 2021, the Labour Party has lost a by-election in Hartlepool. At that point, it looks like Starmer's on borrowed time. It's like his polling is in the toilet. It looks like there's going to be a leadership challenge. There's a by-election in Batley in Spain. I don't know if you guys remember it. And George Galloway runs. And George Galloway is basically running on the principle that the Labour Party has abandoned Muslim voters. And it's basically building on an idea which is, I think, totally justified, that the Labour Party was Islamophobic and certainly that the leadership didn't care about issues of Islamophobia. In that period, in the period of that by-election, Sir Trevor Phillips is readmitted into the Labour Party. despite an ongoing investigation into him for Islamophobic conduct, right? He's readmitted outside of normal processes, it seems. Or at least that's the allegation. There's some sort of unusual way he's been readmitted, that his complaint has been fast-tracked. Now, that story is taken to The Guardian. That story is taken to The Guardian 3 weeks before the by-election results come in. It's also given to the Labour Muslim Network. And we can see, because there was a court case about this, there was an employment tribunal. The Guardian had gone to the Labour Party and stood up the story 2 weeks before the Bagley and Spain by-election was finished. The Guardian only reported that story after the by-election was over, 2 days after they ran that story. Now, that's it's a very profound failure, because it seems to me, at a very basic level, the voters of Batley and Spin deserve to know that. I think it's deeply problematic, Islamophobic, in fact, that The Guardian didn't publish that. I think it shows a real disdain for the Muslim voters of Batley and Spin. Which is all to say, the media is a weird, bizarre, strange, crazy, mad beast. And my experience of dealing with it has been very weird, because on the one hand, my book has made this big impact in certain ways. It's like it's gotten people to resign. There's been loads of stories written about the book, written based on, you know, some of the stories that are broken from the book have led to resignations. And, you know, the book has directly led to Burnham being able to stand and make a film, because it's the book that leads to Josh Simons resigning, right? And yet, it's not been reviewed. It's not been mentioned by name by the BBC, except for the one time I was on Politics Live. The Guardian I don't think has ever mentioned the book by name, even though it's written about me. I'm constantly being written about, never been asked to give comment. It's a weird experience. And I did, you know, what I had to do with the book is I had to, because we knew about the Abaco stuff, we had to smuggle the book into the public domain. And it was this mad experience, like the most bizarre, stressful, crazy thing, where I was basically working with different journalists at different outlets, giving them little tidbits of stories, but never telling them the full story. I'd be like, you can have the Ovenden thing, you can have that, you can have that. Because if I give you this whole book, you're not going to write about it. And that's why the release happened the way that it did, was that we released stories before the book came out, broke some stories, got some protection, and then got some coverage. So we did get some allies, but they're temporary. And, I mean, right now it seems to me very clear that I'm again persona non grata. For a brief period of time it opens up, and then I'm no longer welcome. What it does show is the incredible power of independent media and social media. Because this is the key thing. One of the projects that Morgan McSweeney launches in 2019 is a campaign to destroy the Canary. And he does that because there's internal polling showing the Labour Party membership, which leans towards Corbyn, those who support Corbyn, their most trusted news source was the Canary. It has a profound and deep impact in the Labour Party. I mean, I published a piece in Declassified a couple of weeks ago about an internal briefing note, which was very clear, internal briefing note from Labour Together, saying the Canary is going to decide who's going to be the next Labour leader. That's why they had to destroy it. And, you know, it often feels like we make no difference when we do this journalism, but we plainly do, because that's the reason why the Canary is attacked. That's the reason why the Canary is debanked. That's the reason why there's constant efforts to regulate and constrain social media. Because it's effective. I mean, there was polling that came out yesterday that said that the majority of people in Britain believe there's a genocide in Gaza. The majority of all voters believe there's a genocide in Gaza. Where did they learn that from?
Not the BBC.
Not the BBC, not the Times, not the Telegraph, not even the Guardian. They learned it elsewhere. They learned it from social media and from independent media. So, on the one hand, it's this incredibly stultifying thing that our national pageantry of our politics is performed by the mainstream media. But actually, the substance of our lived epistemological experience is more complicated. And the existence of social media, the existence of alternative media, is so fundamentally important to shaping that reality. And we do need to actively protect independent media. I think it's really interesting, actually. One of the things that's been really good in the last couple of years, Gaza has catalysed, I think, the re-emergence of an independent left media, which is very powerful and is really making like a big impact, which is all a very long way around of saying, please donate to them. It's really hard to be an independent journalist. Please support them if you can. They are incredibly powerful. They can be incredibly powerful. And I think just because the mainstream media is not reporting on them doesn't mean it's not making an impact. You know, I'll give you one more example. It's my favorite example. If you look at the ICJ application, the South Africa file, in January 2024, and you look at the referencing from it, over half of the references proving the case from the South African side are posted on Instagram. Which is precisely why they want to buy TikTok and shut it down. I have a question about the Ford report. The short answer is no. They just simply won't. They already have rejected it. Because the Ford report was very clear that you need to create a professional civil services non-factional. And literally the Labour Party said, we reject that finding. I mean, I should say that it's one of, I haven't spoken about it in a while, but the treatment of Martin Ford, which I write about in the book, is one of the most despicable parts of this project. Really, really, really disgusting. The extent to which that they have really gone out of their way to undermine his reputation. And I think it's really, you know, I think it's telling that he is a voice that should be on the media every day after Henry Novak. He should be giving informed opinions about race and race relations in this country. And basically because he did the right thing, he's not being asked. And if you want to talk about like the moral bankruptcy of this political project, the treatment of Martin Ford, you can't look at that and say this is a moral project. How can you try to gag a black KC from speaking about institutional racism? That's just despicable. It's disgusting. So the answer, sadly, is no. But it doesn't mean we can't embed those learning in other political movements.
Lessons.
I'm not sure what the lessons are. I change my mind on what the lessons are every day. The more anodyne ones, money and politics. This is really the profound issue here, right? Like, this is to understand the Labour Together project is to understand the extent to which a very small handful of donors colluded with political actors to capture a political party of the left. I turn it into a vehicle that's entirely accommodated to capital and the national security state, right? It's precisely because the Labour Party can raise a £4 million donation from Quadrature Capital as the election's heading into, you know, as the 2024 election is being called. It's precisely because Labour Together could fund 100 MPs who have no social base in the Labour Party that the Labour Party could so actively disconnect from its grassroots, right? And it's plain that big money in politics destroys our politics. It's obvious, it's clear. I mean, in America, it's just absolutely out of control. But here, it's profound. And, you know, Transparency International and every single Transparency organisation has said repeatedly that there should be a mandatory cap on donations of £10,000 per person and per company. That's it. Because if you do that, our political parties actually have to raise money from people, from members. They actually have to respond to their needs and wishes. The Labour Party now doesn't. Right? That's why they didn't mind losing 250,000 members. It didn't matter. They had 10 wealthy donors to prop them up. If you end that, it's a very profound change to the political cycle if you do that. Lessons for the left. Radical democracy. Really. The Labour Together project and the Labour Party is the most clear illustration of how deeply and profoundly corrupted our politics are when we don't embed grassroots democracy. Well, you don't make it a basic de facto thing that your MP has to get the backing of the membership every time they run in a general election. Not some mad trigger process, not some bureaucratic thing, not something that can be managed, that it's a standard thing in America, you have open primaries. The open primary system is transformative to democracy. It really is. It doesn't fix everything, but the current barriers to entry in a place like the Labour Party, Zoran Mamdani would never emerge in our political system under the Labour Party. Never in a million years. It's impossible for him to emerge in the system. And he, you know, he could be, you know, if he was born in America, he could realistically be a president. At the moment, he's like going to become a democratic kingmaker, right? And this is a guy from outside of politics, you know, started with a 1% polling figure. I was listening to an interview with Mehdi Hassan recently. The first interview with Zoran Mamdani, he gave it to him out of pity because nobody thought he had a chance. And he's transforming politics in America, right? And then I suppose the last one is, I suppose I have to talk about anti-Semitism, because it is a key issue. It's a key issue in the Greens. And I haven't totally thought through the lessons to be learned then and what should be done. But I think what we should start with is to understand the discursive structure of the anti-Semitism crisis first, so that we can then decide how to respond to it being used again. And the discursive structure is quite simple. The way the anti-Semitism crisis was run was that there were a group of people in the Labour Party and in the media who wanted to try and make the allegation and find proof that the Labour Party under Corbyn was inherently, deeply, intrinsically, inexorably anti-Semitic. And the way you do that is you basically create a unstated social ledger where every example of anti-Semitism you find from a left-wing person isn't just an isolated example of anti-Semitism, but is indicative of a movement. Right? So in the end, actually, if you look at the number of complaints that are filed in the Labour Party, there's, you know, maybe 1,000 people that I looked through the files who are guilty of, like, genuine anti-Semitism. But it's an entirely toxic thing to basically take these individual examples of some random weirdo out in the sticks posting Rothschild's memes and saying, ha, we're going to report this and say this is fundamental. This actually reflects on this whole movement. That's the discursive structure. Every example creates a social ledger. Because the inverse is where it really becomes problematic. So if that's happening, the defensive response is to say that's not anti-Semitic. If every example of anti-Semitism is being added to an undeclared social ledger proving the left is anti-Semitic, the defensive response is to say that's not anti-Semitic. From the right side, in order to prove this argument, they have to expand the definition of anti-Semitism as widely as possible. So criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic. But on the left, the instinct will be to say, no, anti-Semitism is this tiny little thing. Now that's toxic, because what it means, you can't actually have a meaningful fight against anti-Semitism where you identify examples of anti-Semitism and you talk to people and you explain to them why it's anti-Semitic. And you help them through it. And for me, one of the things we need to do, and I'm not sure how possible it is, but I've been thinking about it, for the Green Party, obviously they were dealt with this campaign in the local election, if this stuff was reheated again. I think that the line should be, anti-Semitism is too serious to be dealt with in this way. We need to remove it from this discourse and not engage with it altogether and be like, sorry, we're not playing this game. This discursive structure is destructive to everyone. This is not helpful. We'll deal with it on our own terms. And then within that, I think we should have certain things. One thing is this idea of zero tolerance, which is the key thing. This idea of zero tolerance, it sounds great, right? Like, of course we have no tolerance for racism. But what zero tolerance means in practice is one strike and you're out. It means somebody can't grow, they can't learn. It means that if you want to fight a political battle, you go find somebody's Facebook post from 2007 where they were drunk online and had seen Israel killing a Palestinian, like the idea of killing a Palestinian, and they posted something that they regret. And they're erased from the political process as a result. So there definitely has to be a moral way to deal with anti-Semitism that both embeds the fight against anti-Semitism, but also takes it out of this political weaponization process. I think there is a moral path that can be developed on the left. I'm not clear exactly how it could be done. I'm not an expert on it. But I think it's urgent. Also Free Palestine.
Thank you so much, Paul. That was honestly such a fascinating discussion. I'm sure everyone else here agrees. If you haven't already, honestly, I can't recommend this enough. It's quite a weighty book, but it's such a page-turner, and it's so well-written and brilliantly researched. It's a really must-have to have on your bookshelf. And Paul is selling some copies over there, and he will stay behind for a few minutes and sign some copies for people. Secondly, if you've enjoyed this meeting, we are Counterfire, talking about, you know, grassroots building, you know, from the bottom up, and, you know, taking on the ruling classes who, you know, and building a society that is, you know, built on welfare, built on fairness and equality is what we're all about. So if you're interested in joining Counterfire, then please go and see our store and sign up, get some information. We've got a fantastic website. There's some brilliant articles on there written by some, you know, brilliant people within, you know, from all aspects of the, you know, movement and things like that. So please do go and check it out. We also have a free paper, which we do monthly, so grab yourself a copy of the paper. There's a couple of dates coming up as well. So next Saturday, there's a national demonstration for Palestine. It is being sort of titled as, you know, we're going to tell the new PM that we are not going anywhere. The movements on the streets, you know, Palestine has to be, you know, at the forefront as well. It has to be part of the discussion. You know, as Paul said, you know, it's gonna make or break, you know, people like Andy and Andy Burnham and, you know, Labour going on as well on issues like this. So it's so important that we're, you know, putting it out there and that we're, you know, set a strong presence on the streets. So do come along if you can. Tickets are available on Head First. There's a QR code here and there's one over on the stall as well. The next Counterfire meeting will be here again on the 22nd of July, Wednesday, and it is on Lessons from a Revolution, 90 years on from the Spanish Revolution, so Civil War, that's the one. So we've got Chris Nyden coming down to speak then, so please do come along. Yeah, it should be another fascinating meeting on a completely different topic, or maybe not. There's probably some crossover there as well. And then the day after, we've got the national protest at Elbit Systems on Thursday the 23rd of July. Obviously, most people know here, Bristol is home to the Israeli arms manufacturer Elbit, so we're having a national demonstration from PSC, so we're hopefully going to be having people coming down from all over the country, and it's 11 till 1pm, and there's some flyers, so with the address details and stuff over on the store, so pick yourself one up there. And yeah, so please join Counterfire, and hope you enjoyed it, and hope to see you on the 22nd.